Good morning. It's April 24th, Tuesday morning. This is the Senate Resources Committee, and we're going to be receiving a presentation this morning from PFC Energy. We do have a quorum with us today, beginning in the far left, Senator Stevens, Senator French, Senator Stedman on my far right, Senator McGuire, and Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Senator Pasquin. Before we commence today's hearing, we would like to have Representative Hawker make a brief presentation. There was an issue that arose last week as far as PFC Energy and who PFC Energy may or may not have been working for. So in order to provide Representative Hawker, who is the person that I believe that is originally contracted with PFC Energy, give the opportunity to provide, so to speak, what's going on. So Representative Hawker, welcome. Please identify yourself. And for the record, Senator Wagner, co-chair, is excused, but I believe he will be here as of this afternoon. So anyway, Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For your record-keeping purposes, I am Representative Mike Hawker, representing District 32 in Anchorage. As I'm here before you today, I am sitting in my capacity as the chairman of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to clear up an issue that arose in, I believe it was your last meeting. And there were comments made that brought into question who our consultants, PFC Energy, are working for and their relationship with the Department of Revenue, as specifically as it relates to the fiscal system model they have developed for us. Mr. Chair, just as a brief matter of background, myself and Senator Stedman, who is my vice chair in the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, as we anticipated this coming legislative session, we recognized the need for the legislature to have some top-notch, world-class consulting capacity specifically to evaluate these oil and gas fiscal systems and the potential legislative proposals. Between the two of us, we looked around at a lot of options, looked at a lot of folks, a lot are conflicted out as quality consultants because they work for one vested party or another. We identified PFC Energy and went to our Legislative Budget and Audit Committee with a request. The Legislative Budget and Audit Committee engage PFC Energy solely for the purposes of supporting the legislature in the development and evaluation of these fiscal systems, as has certainly been evidenced and witnessed by their testimony and developments with your committees in the Senate over the past legislative session. One of the critical elements of the contract, a foundational element of the contractual relationship we, the legislature, through the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee established with PFC Energy, was that they would have to develop a comprehensive model of our oil and gas fiscal system, so they're able to model the consequences of proposed policy changes. Part of that modeling effort, there are two critical elements within our contract. One, as we have always done in the legislative process, we recognize that one person cannot develop an economic model in isolation. We've seen in previous years where we end up what we euphemistically call dueling models, and it's the question, is your model right or is my model right? Your whole premise is wrong. And we wanted very much, Senator Stedman and I wanted very, very much to avoid any questions on dueling models. So we specifically directed PFC Energy, both contractually and in the scoping meetings that we held with them prior to this legislative session, that as fiscal models were developed and as these models evolve, as new propositions come on the table, we wanted them to feel free to talk with the other people in the involved stakeholder group here that are also modeling the potential systems that we're looking at. And if there are discrepancies, to sit down with them and resolve those discrepancies, again, so that we don't have one agency coming in and saying, hey, look, your model's just wrong. You guys are just totally off base. That is what occurred recently with PFC's modeling as it related to some of the final work product that was coming out of the Senate Finance Committee at the end of legislative session. Department of Revenue was taking the same input data and coming up with a somewhat different consequential analysis than PFC had had. And again, without completely within the scope of the direction that Senator Stedman and I had given to PFC, PFC took a limited function, you can call it sort of a snapshot out of their model, snapshot calculation with a specific set of data to the Department of Revenue and asked them to evaluate it and say, well, why aren't we coming up with the same numbers? As a consequential result of that, there was an issue identified within PFC's model that resulted in a small change. That small change actually resulted in an amendment that was processed in the Senate Finance Committee as the modeling efforts were reconciled. And, Mr. Chairman, that is absolutely all that has ever occurred with relation to PFC and the administration. PFC works solely for the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee and through us for the legislature. I have been, after hearing the testimony that occurred in this committee a couple of days ago, I embarked on a fairly lengthy investigatory process to absolutely validate and verify what I have just told you is true. I have received absolute assurance from the people that work in the Department of Revenue, not from the executives, but from the people that work there, that PFC's modeling was never utilized in any capacity in any program that was or policy proposal that was developed by the Department of Revenue that underlied the legislation that was introduced as both House Bill and Senate Bill 3001. So, Mr. Chairman, I hope that clarifies the role that PFC has had in their involvement with the Department of Revenue. I truly believe the record the previous committee meeting is easily misinterpreted to imply something else, but I assure you PFC is independent of the administration, independent of the industry, and works solely for the legislature through the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. Any questions? Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Representative Hawker, and that's what we suspected, and we're pleased to have you confirm that. But while we have you here, are there additional consultants that you have prepared to work with the House and the Senate during this special session?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, we have, the legislature, again, through the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, have the most involved contractual relationship, of course, with PFC Energy. We also have an ongoing relationship with Mr. David Wood and Associates, which is related primarily to developing modeling for gas fiscal systems. So it's really not, respectfully, not relevant to this particular legislative session. We have small contracts for, you know, I call it quick services. You want something quickly analyzed, simple modeling. With Roger Marks and also with Dan Dickinson. I'm trying to think through my own head here. Is there anyone I'm looking for my lifeline here. I think that's, and Senator Stedman, I think that's the inventory, is it not, sir?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the past, we've really had unfettered access to our consultants. I know during ACES we had unfettered access to the consultants, and in this process, I've never had PFC Energy in my office. I'd like to be able to freely call them up, ask them questions, and we've been told that we need to funnel the questions through LB&A, and then they'll funnel them to PFC, who will get back to you, who will then get back to us. And I'm wondering if you would be willing to allow us legislators to have the same unfettered access to PFC that we've had two consultants in the past.
And through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, all legislators have access to PFC. However, we have those of us that have been in this process for over 10 years have had a lot of experience with the need to perform triage so that our consultants are utilized most effectively and efficiently, and that so first and foremost, they receive or they provide the support services necessary for committee work. So as we have, and in order to make certain that there is no question to PFC as in where their priorities ought to be delivered, we do have contractual provisions in our operating contract with them that their service requests do go through the chair of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, a single point of access to to make it effective and efficient for PFC. That said, this is the first I've heard anyone say they have been denied access to PFC, which I frankly don't believe it's true, because I don't believe we've ever had any specific requests that have not been responded to. But PFC does, in fact, work first and foremost for committees and chairs, and committee members of those chairs, and we've asked as a purely procedural matter that requests for PFC work or modeling go through the chairs of the committee, again, for the most efficient and effective utilization of services that are actually quite costly, quite expensive, and respectfully, they're a limited resource we have. There's 60 individual legislators, and if PFC had to respond independently, individually to 60 legislators, individual legislators, without some format of management or triage, I think we'd find a situation that broke down in its efficiency fairly quickly. So all I ask as the chair of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee is that requests be prioritized, hopefully through the chairs of your committee, and someone that wants specific work done, we will absolutely request that if it is possible for PFC to do that work, we will do it for individual legislators, but on a priority sequence that is below, with respectfully, it's below that of the committees. And we've done work like that for Senator French. He had some requests early on. And again, PFC had the resources at the time, and we did not interfere with their committee work. We were able to follow and comply with those requests. So, Senator, I would request as a member of this committee that you would direct your request through the chair of this committee, and we're very happy to accommodate it.
Senator French.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative Hawker.
Good morning, Senator French.
A question, I think the question, this whole sort of episode began when we heard from the Commissioner of Revenue describing how they had built the numbers for the current governor's bill, working, and I guess we could all pick our words carefully, in conjunction with, alongside with, in consultation with PFC and their models. And the reason I asked the question of the commissioner was because my understanding was that we would get a deliverable model to the legislature that PFC would build for us that we could turn the dials on. So that Senator Wilikowski or Senator Stevens or Senator McGuire or Senator Giesel, anyone could sort of take a look and see what sort of tax outcome would come from a certain set of inputs. And I get that was the cause of at least my question to the commissioner and my confusion, because I queried the chief aide to the finance committee, asked them, have we seen this model? They said, no, we haven't seen it. And so I was surprised to learn that the revenue commissioner was working, at least seeing a prototype of a PFC model or a parallel version of the PFC model alongside the revenue commissioner's model. And so that was why I asked. And so maybe my statement is all leading up to a question, and that is, do you expect for us to get a model from PFC? And if so, when?
Senator French, through the chair, our contractual arrangement with PFC Energy, as it was specifically discussed and anticipated and planned through myself and Senator Stedman, was that PFC's fiscal system model would be turned over to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee and thereby to the legislature at the conclusion of their engagement. And the reason for that occurring is that this model evolves every time there's a new proposal placed on the table. So if we had them try to provide some kind of a model that people took off and started using, every time you come up with a new proposal, a new structure, with any of the multiplicity of variables inherent in our tax fiscal system, that model would become very rapidly obsolete, and there would always be the question of, well, which version are you using? Which version do you have? Which version do you have? So again, in order to prevent and make sure that it was always clear that the model was, the only point of contact with the utilization of that model through this engagement would be through PFC Energy, but at the end of the day, their work product, the money we've invested in developing that fiscal system model, would be turned over to the legislature.
And just a quick follow-up. Thanks. And I've read the contract and gone back and reviewed the transcript of the LB&A hearing in December when we approved this contract. And I think there's at least a little bit of potential, there's several different interpretations of how that reads. And I guess, for my own purposes and my own education process, it would have been more helpful, I think, to get at least prototypes of models or evolving models as they were developed.
with the caveat that it's obviously not representative of anything, any final product. But again, there's 60 of us trying to understand and grapple with this issue, and having some access to a financial tool as the process is ongoing, I think, is far superior than waiting until the process is over, the last vote has been cast, the law is now on the books, and then we sort of get the tools to do the analysis. Can you see how it seems a little reversed?
Senator French, I understand what you're requesting, but I believe you're requesting an entirely different type of work product than we engage PSC to provide. We engage them to provide reactive services, reactive analytical and modeling services to the policy developments proposed by committees. Developing some sort of what we would call a dashboard system, a dashboard model, where you have all the, you keep referring to it in these committees, all the buttons and the dials and the levers that you wish to push and change as it might affect a fiscal system, which would require absolutely comprehensive anticipatory modeling, is a quite substantial task. And we can look at what David Wood has attempted to do with a gas fiscal system model. It's a horrendously complex, detailed model trying to create a dashboard. But again, every time a new question is raised, that model becomes obsolete and needs further evolution. Respectfully, we wish that sort of modeling activity, and if you like, perhaps we could find someone else to develop a secondary model, a backstop model for that purposes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you,
Representative. Well, Representative Hocker, we do appreciate your appearing before the committee to explain this. And, you know, one of the questions that arose in my mind when we were finding out about this truing up of the models so that we don't have dueling models, do you know whether the Gaffney-Klein advisors have been participants in that process?
Through the chair, or Mr. Chairman, I have no knowledge of anything to do with Gaffney-Klein. And if I might, sir, just a concluding comment. The critical word, and I would like to bring it forward here, is credibility. What is absolutely essential that we as legislators have is the respect and the credibility of the consultants that are working for us. And that, again, is why we're also very, very concerned about bringing interim work product or work product that is incomplete into the public domain, because it would always cause and call into question. We would always have to ask, well, is the output of that product credible under the circumstances that are being proposed? At what time frame is it relevant? So, sir, the entire engagement structure was structured to provide the utmost assurance to the legislature to protect and preserve the absolute credibility of PSC Energy and their work they perform for us.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Mr. Chairman, I think as another note, I think when we're debugging the model we're currently using, I think there was an error found or noticed actually in one of the three producers' models for them to correct. So this has been a pretty much a standard procedure, making sure that the models from both the industry, the Department of Revenue, and the legislature, given a particular set of inputs, come out with reasonably close output, so we concentrate on the policy discussion, not on a discussion of, you know, whose model is best. So I think that there's a benefit to all three participants, you know, in this exercise.
There would certainly appear to be a high value in making sure that it's not whose system is right or wrong, and that the systems are coordinated so that, as you say, they are trued up. And so any further questions by committee members? Representative Hocker, thank you for appearing this morning and providing that explanation.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I'd be remiss, and I want to make sure that there's absolutely no questions to my credibility or any issue that I'm involved with here. We have utilized, and essentially PFC has satisfied their initial contractual obligation to the legislature, which were the modeling and services to be performed during the regular session. As we've gone into special session, as it was understood with PFC before the legislative session began, quite frankly, we've kind of reached the end of our well as far as our authority to continue to utilize them. We will be bringing that question back before the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee in a meeting that I'm attempting to schedule for tomorrow afternoon, where I will be asking the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to authorize an additional increment of spending for PFC's contract. Should any member of the legislature wish to cease using the services of PFC Energy, that would be the meeting to come and express those concerns. But otherwise, I believe they have provided, personally, I believe they have provided absolutely outstanding service of the highest possible caliber, and that we should continue to use them during the legislative special session. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very sincerely appreciate the opportunity to be
just
here.
Senator Stedman has a question or comment.
No, just a brief comment, Mr. Chairman. I think the three producers have had their model for quite some time and been working with ACES and before that PPT. The administration also through Gaffney Klein, where PFC was engaged. I think they started this process in December. Is that correct? Somewhere in there? In November?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, that is absolutely correct. They did preliminary work in meeting with industry, identifying their understanding of the circumstances, situations of both our fiscal regime and how the producers in the state are reactive to that fiscal regime. And it has given them the basis they really have had for being able to talk with the legislative committees and provide sort of an interpretation of how proposals that we make might be received and might, in fact, be determinant of changed behavior in the world of Alaska's oil and gas producers.
I just make that point, Mr. Chairman, just because of the compressed time frame that PFC had to work in to get a complex model on the table relative to the other two participants, the industry and the administration, who have had theirs on the shelf for quite some time, for a couple of years.
And it would be fair to say, Mr. Chairman, and through Senator Stedman, that both industry and the Department of Revenue themselves have had to continually and constantly evolve their own models of economic system for the consequences of legislative proposals, which, of course, every one of these is something new. It's never been incorporated before, so it requires reprogramming and then debugging of those programs.
Again, Representative Hocker, I believe it's been useful to providing this foundation information so that some of these issues can be better understood. We have one additional question.
Yeah, just a question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would it be possible to get a detailed copy of the billing statements from PFC Energy?
Of course, those are public records.
All right. Could I request that?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Hocker, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And actually, I want to say that we do not the bill, and if I might on that one, we have received the services billing. We do not have at this time their billing for out-of-pocket expenses as they've accumulated it through this process. And there, as we also, we do not have PFC Energy's internal time records, the detailed records. We've got the invoices that were interpretive of their internal records. If we want to go anything beyond the detail of their invoicing to us, that would require a information request from the with more detail than we've been provided in the traditional billing records. It would require an additional request to PFC Energy. But again, we're awaiting a very detailed accounting with supporting documentation, of course, for their out-of-pocket costs in accordance with our contractual provisions.
Given that, we will now welcome Mr. Janik Mayer, PFC Energy. And, Mr. Mayer, do you need any time to get set up, or are you ready to launch into the presentation?
Mr. Chair, largely ready to launch. Perhaps just 10 seconds to pour myself a glass of water, if I may.
Mayor, welcome. Please identify yourself, state your affiliation, and then begin with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Janik Mayer. I am a manager in the upstream and gas practice at PFC Energy and project manager for this engagement that we are undertaking for the legislature through LBNA committee, providing analysis for discussion of fiscal terms reform for the legislature. I wanted to present for the committee, if I could, a series of slides looking briefly at some of the background issues that we've discussed before, both at Senate Resources and also Senate Finance Committee, in terms of the impact of ACES on existing legacy assets and for higher cost new assets, and then look at specifically at Senate Bill 3001, what that looks like, and what its impact is on some of that potentially higher cost new production, but also what the costs that come with putting a regime like that is in place in terms of its impact on revenue to the state? One of the things that we've talked about a number of times, both in testimony I've given before to Senate Resources Committee and also to Senate Finance Committee, is this question of increasingly high costs for developing new projects in Alaska. This is an updated version of a slide that presented before in testimony, looking at our estimates of what it costs to bring on online a new barrel of production, particularly looking at the obvious competitor regimes for investment at the moment in the lower 48, so looking at the cost of unconventionals in particular in Louisiana and North Dakota and Texas, and at the even cheaper end of things, completely conventional onshore production in those states as well. What we see is that new light oil in Alaska has, and this is a very broad generalization, but not dissimilar capital costs to some of the unconventionals that we see in the lower 48, but higher operating costs, and that as we get to higher cost new developments, whether those are viscous oil developments, whether those are developments that require complex and higher technology horizontal wells, whether those are developments targeting tighter accumulations of oil, whether those are developments further out from existing infrastructure requiring significant new infrastructure to be developed. In any of those circumstances, we get to significantly more expensive development costs, and some of the numbers that we were looking at in terms of modeling, particularly at the end of the session in Senate Finance a week or so ago, we were looking at numbers of sort of, in particular, of what new developments look like at $17, $24, and $35 a barrel in capital costs, and what that looks like under the ACES structure, and then what that looks like under different incentives for new production, for instance.
Mr. Mayor, before we continue forward, what would these bars look like if you were to control or to accommodate for the credits and the deductions? In other words, Alaska's system is a net profit system as compared to other systems are not net profit systems. And so we in Alaska have 100% deduction for those qualified expenses, both operating expenses and capital expenses, and we have a 20% capital expense deduction from the bottom line. How would those bars change if you were to reflect those relative to other jurisdictions with don't have anything similar to Alaska?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. This obviously is just a snapshot of the actual costs involved in developing a project. It's certainly true that the state of Alaska has significant credits that other states don't, that help go towards the initial upfront financing, essentially, of some of those costs, in that a producer is swiftly able to recoup some of those costs, you know, 20% capital credit, 25% net operating loss credit for a producer who isn't currently producing, or the ability to write down, deduct that expense off their existing production tax base. On the other hand, if that's the comparison, one can only make that comparison in terms of then looking, well, what's the government take that then also occurs through that system, which, as we've seen a number of times in slides we put before the committee, is substantially higher here than otherwise. So, I mean, ACES in that sense is a system deliberately set up to, on the one hand, have a high level of government take, and on the other hand, make at least particularly low-cost existing production economic and an ongoing investment at a particular level, at a particular cost structure in those fields, economic, precisely through that question of credits. Those credits are integral and essential to the system in as far as they're part of what balances out the high level of government take and enables some degree of investment, at least, to be economic despite that high level of government take.
Yes, and, we see cost structure, but kind of what I've referred to in the past is kind of oil field economics 101. It's, what are the costs is the first step. The second step is what is its value or what is it worth? And then the third step is what is the rate of return, net present value or internal rate of return. And so, I always want to be cautious of only looking at one component of that economics 101 analysis. And so I think that it's important to understand that Alaska, when it, you know, Alaska is a participant with the industry in those operating expenses and capital expenses, and I just want to make sure the viewing public doesn't misunderstand that it's just a cost-only analysis. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding is that on development costs, the state picks up about 60% of the development costs. Is that accurate?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, that will obviously vary a lot depending on particular circumstances. For instance, any of the recent new developments we've seen, for instance, Anakayachik and Ruguruk, for instance, were done by producers without previous production base. So in that sense, the principal things that they're able to claim in the course of developing something are the 20% capital credit and the 25% net operating loss credit. Particularly, once one is factored in the interplay of those two things with state and federal taxes, my modelling suggests that that's probably around the equivalent of the state taking about 35% of the development cost. But I can look into that in more detail. That number would be higher for an existing producer when you also have the ability to write down, deduct those expenses off your existing taxable basis. I think producers would probably argue that the ability to deduct their expenses in any net profits tax system doesn't necessarily imply the state is somehow contributing that toward the development cost, but on the other hand, it's absolutely true that if one looks on an after-tax cash flow basis, in that sense, when you combine significant credits with the ability to deduct off a progressive tax, that there is a substantially lesser impact in those early years of capital spending compared to the actual amount spent.
Follow up.
I do think that's important, Mr. Chairman. I think just following up on your statement before, and I would like to see more information, because my understanding is it would be a roughly 60%, which if you looked at the new LIDAR, for instance, at $32, the state would be picking up 60% of that, which would knock that down significantly to less than what the costs are in Eagleford, Texas, less than what the costs are in Bakken, less than what the costs are in Haynesville. So I think when you add up the credits, the deductions, the tax breaks, it is a fairly significant number, and I think this chart does not adequately present that information.
Mr. Mayor, is there any comment, or would you?
The one comment I'd make is that I think particularly when it comes to looking at the question of credits, one useful way of looking at this, I've presented a few slides on this to Senate Finance before, but I can present them here in the future as well if that's desirable, is to think of those credits as comparable to the question of an analogy of to the state of Alaska as an equity investor in a project, and how does that initial investment, particularly in the form of the credits, look compared to the revenue that comes in the form of production taxes and other taxes to the state of Alaska, and how does that compare to other regimes that do something similar? So, for instance, one of the best comparisons might be, for instance, to Australia, which has a similarly generous system of credits and deductions, in this case, ones that are not taken upfront in the first years, as the Alaska system is, but taken out of production later, but maintained in net present value terms to be equivalent. That's a system with no other components in terms of royalty and property tax and other things, just one profit-based tax plus income taxes. That's a system that was designed to say, essentially, we want to take a 40% share of things. The state will contribute to 40% of the costs, like an equity investor with a 40% stake, and take 40% of the cash flows that come from the project. If one looks at the state of Alaska and how its system compares, it's a more complex system. It's one that sees the state put in a not uncomfortable share of the costs, particularly for a new development. But it's one that sees the state take significantly more than a 35 or 40% share of the revenues once one adds up production tax, royalty, and all the rest. So it's absolutely true that the state of Alaska makes the economics of that high level of government take significantly more palatable by putting up some share of those initial costs, but it's the state of Alaska, you know, is absolutely, in that sense, an investor in these projects through the tax system, but it's also a lopsided investor that takes more than it puts in. That's not, I mean, it's its resource, and that's not to say that that's a bad thing, but it's not only putting up the cost, it's also taking a significant share of the revenues as a result. And from that investment, there are significant revenues that come to the state of Alaska.
I think it's important for the viewing public to understand that under Alaska's credit system, for example, that through fiscal year 13, I believe it will be a cumulative $5 billion that Alaska will have invested in the infrastructure development of the Central North Slope. And so we should not forget that. And again, while the capital expenditures are costly, that Alaska is a participant in that process. And so, and even to the extent of providing cash to those that currently do not have production, where the Treasury, I believe in this year is $400 million, where we are paying cash to operators without current production. So I think that it's an important point for the viewing public to keep in mind.
Mr. Chair, I'd absolutely agree that that's the case, and in particular when we come to look in more detail at Senate Bill 3001, when it comes to, for instance, the question of extending that 40% well work credit to the North Slope, there are some serious impacts that come from all the things that we've been discussing here about the impact of combining high levels of credits with high levels of progressivity and the ability to write those down in terms of high levels of government support for certain forms of spending, and we'll get into that in a little more detail later in the deck as well.
Leave Senator French, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on this slide about the costs of comparing Alaska costs to other places, the Bakken development, in the middle of the slide, you have it listed as about $22 for OPEX and CAPEX. I've seen the numbers far higher than that, up to $50 for developing the Bakken. How do you... Where does this number come from? How sure of it are you?
Senator French, thank you for the question. We have a team of people in Houston who focus specifically on North American unconventionals because it's a significant part of the work that we do. And this comes from their cost estimation efforts. Now, I mean, one of the most important things to say about anything to do with North American unconventionals is there is huge amounts of variation within any given play in terms of the economics of any of these things. One of the things we've tried to do here is, for instance, particularly considering that there are three big players up here that we're looking at, is to the extent that any of them have particularly large stakes in some of these plays, which may be better or worse in terms of the costs and the economics that come from them, to try to make these more reflective of those positions rather than necessarily the play as a whole. So that's one of the things that impacts that. But depending where one is looking in a play, whether one is talking about, you know, acreage near what we term the sweet spot, where wells can have very high initial productivity and thus higher levels of production for a given level of investment, you'll see variation in costs that are quoted. This is our best estimate, particularly as it relates to the companies that are up here and their alternative investment opportunities of what we think the costs are.
Just a follow-up. So the price here for the Bakken, is that sort of homogenized across the Bakken? Or it sounded as if you were trying to isolate how the Bakken, what the Bakken costs for companies doing business in Alaska, or did I misunderstand you?
Specifically for the Bakken, I can look into that in more detail for you, Senator French. I can certainly tell you, for example, when it comes to something like the Haynesville, probably our capital costs might be lower there than a broader estimate solely for the Haynesville, and that's particularly, for instance, for the impact of the large position that ExxonMobil through XTO has there, which is a very highly economic and relatively lower cost position, and we wanted to reflect some of that because we're talking about particular companies up here and their alternative investment opportunities. So to the extent possible, we've tried to target the analysis to say there are actual companies up here that we're talking about and they have actual alternative investment opportunities and try to make it reflective of that rather than a purely homogenized look.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm trying to listen as fast as Janik speaks, but it's difficult. He's a very bright man with a very fast speaking style. Thank you.
Mr. French, Senator French, I will try to slow down. My apologies.
You know, Mr. Mayor, you know, we're seeing these CapEx, you know, the cost structures, and I believe in one of your other presentations you were providing an analysis in past years where North America, as far as cash flows, where North America was being used as a cash source to fund operations, for example, overseas, and then in the last several years, other regions of the world have been used as a cash source to fund operations in North America. And I believe the term you used is it was a cash deficit region. But anyway, if Alaska were to develop shale oil, would you expect to see CapEx, in other words, capital expenditure investment, to significantly increase in Alaska?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I think a lot would depend on the nature of the shale resource as was found here and the economics that apply to it. There is nothing uniform or predictable about the development of the unconventional play either in North America or anywhere else in the world. There are particular factors that apply in the lower 48 that are in some ways unique to the lower 48 when one looks at sort of the combination of private land holding, numerous players, very, very high volumes of wells being drilled, and the learning through experimentation that's come from that that hasn't been emulated anywhere else in the world yet. You know, at last count, I think we had significantly more than 12,000 wells drilled in terms of the unconventional play in the lower 48, and looking at other jurisdictions around the world, I think the next highest number of wells was less than 12. It's those 12,000 wells that have meant that there's been that extraordinary competition and development of technology that's enabled that revolution. What the nature of the play will be here in Alaska, if it's eventually successful, what the costs involved are, you know, one of the fundamentals in that sense of unconventional resource development is it's a very intensive development in terms of sheer numbers of wells that you drill to get anything out of the play, and what that looks like in a North Dakota or in particularly a Louisiana or Texas is very different to what that looks like up here, given the questions of remoteness, climate, terrain, etc. So there are a lot of things that could make that development significantly more difficult in Alaska than in the lower 48, but that's not to say that extraordinary things are also not possible.
And part of the Senate bill, in other words, during the regular session, the Senate passed a new fields tax incentive, and shale oil is located in that region of the new fields. And do you see that component of the tax bill would provide a significant incentive to new field development, for example, shale oil, new field development?
Mr. Chair, certainly compared to the existing system, it provides a significant incentive. When it comes to things like shale and at the highest level of costs, for instance, future developments and things like heavy or ultra-heavy, depending how one categorizes these things, oil, there are categories of resource that are particularly expensive that may still have challenged economics, even under the most generous provisions that have been looked at so far. For instance, new production, both under what the Senate was considering and under Senate Bill 3001. My analysis to date would suggest that suddenly, that at that highest level of costs, and if one were, for instance, to think of that $34 a barrel as not unreasonable either for shale or for heavy oil, that it's possible that those economics could still be marginal even at that point. They're significantly better than they are under the ACES system, absolutely. It may be that that's sufficient incentive to bring those highest cost developments into place, but it may be that at that highest cost end of the spectrum, even that much of an incentive is not yet enough. But that's not something I've done a lot of analysis on, because most of the analysis to date has concerned things in the more immediate future and the more immediately foreseeable cost range.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just just looking very, very briefly online, there's a Petroleum News article from last week, actually, where it says Bakken producers, depending on location and other factors, must receive from $40 to as much as $60 per barrel of oil to stay in business, according to industry representatives. So I don't know how, if your information that you have here showing it's $22 for CapEx OpEx is dated or what, but at least in the Petroleum News as of a week ago, they're saying $40 to $60.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, if I heard you correctly, that was $40 to $60 as a price that they must receive to stay in business. So if one takes that $40 to $60 for a barrel, takes out 50, 60% government take, that then we're down to 20 or 30, then that would actually imply lower costs than you're seeing on the screen once one has also factored in, you know, a minimum 15% return on capital.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Another slide we've presented before in Senate Resources Committee is this question of what's the impact of progressivity under ACES on price upsides to oil companies. It's a question that was initially asked by members of this committee, having heard testimony from oil companies about the question of ACES taking away the upside at high oil prices. On the screen we have two charts of taking sort of the standard small 10,000 barrel a day new development production profile that we've used for a range of analyses here and applying to it the lowest possible level of costs, of essentially costs that come straight out of the Department of Revenue Sources 2013 numbers, applying those to a new development and saying if hypothetically one could get a new development today, what would that look like in terms of at those costs, what would that look like in terms of project value across a range of prices? On the left, we have what that would look like in terms of net present value for a project at a range of prices. On the right, internal rates of return across a range of prices. And what that would look like, for instance, under a completely flat, purely 25% profit stack. So if one stripped out progressivity from the ACES regime altogether and just had that flat 25%. And of course, what that progressivity does is it bends down that curve in order to take more and more of the project value for the state and less for the contractor at those high oil prices. Now, when one has a low-cost development, as is represented here, that's not really a problem for the economics of the project. This is ACES doing exactly what it was designed to do, which is, you know, if what one thinks is one has an existing resource base with an existing cost structure and that's going to keep going out and declining into the future, and what the state wants to do is maximize its available, ensure that that flow continues, that the basic level investment required to maintain that basic decline continues, but capture as much of the resource as possible for the state. The NACES is a very good regime to do that, and that's what you're seeing here, which is, you know, you have positive economics, you have, in this sense, a 15% rate of return at a relatively low price deck, and then above that, steadily more and more being captured by the state to ensure that it gets the greatest possible revenue from its resource. Where that picture changes is when we start looking at the impact of higher costs on this scenario and what the bending of that curve looks like as we look at that. So for instance, if we move to slide 5, that red line is the same as we saw on the previous slide of what that looks like if we were to take that sort of hypothetical 10,000 barrel a day development and apply average costs across the slope to it as forecast for Department of Revenue 2013. And then if we steadily increase the capital costs to the ranges that we've been looking at, again, particularly in recent weeks, here at this table with Senate Finance Committee, of what that looks like for at $17 a barrel in capital costs and $15 a barrel in OPEX. And then if one takes that capital cost even higher to $25 or $34 a barrel, what does that do to project value? And in particular, what's striking to me is the question of that curving that comes from progressivity, the bending of the curve, which in the lowest price case is simply taking away more of the economic rent, more of the super profits, essentially, that would accrue to a producer with a low-cost production profile, but in the highest cost cases, what that's doing is bending the point at which the project begins to break even or begins to earn a reasonable rate of return simply to repay its capital. So that, you know, in the highest case, you know, for instance, the $34 a barrel capex case, if one were to imagine a straight line coming from down below, you know, one could, were it not for the impact of progressivity, one might have, say, for instance, a $90 point of NPV 10 break-even on that project. Instead, what one has is $120 or $130 before the project achieves any positive economic value, and that's the impact of that progressivity, which in the lowest cost case is simply taking extra economic rent and capturing it for the state, but in the highest cost case is significantly driving up the break-even prices for those high-cost developments.
If we could just briefly return to page 4, the two charts, one is NPV, net present value, and then the one on the right is IRR, that's internal rate of return.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And I, under this chart, it looks like at about $100 a barrel, the internal rate of return is 20%+. And is that an acceptable internal rate of return?
Mr. Chair, this is, what one thing I should clarify is that this is a particularly sort of hypothetical form of analysis, and that it looks at the economics of a new development. One can't even calculate an internal rate of return if one isn't looking at a new development in the form of having initial capital spend up front and then production that comes from that. And so it's asking the question, if one could have a new development with the cost structure of what we see being spent on a year-by-year basis on the existing fields, what would that look like? So one can't, in that sense, measure internal rate of return on the existing fields at the moment, because they're not... Internal rate of return as a concept depends on having that initial upfront spend of capital and then what's the return that comes from it. So this is an analogy that allows us to approach something like that, but it's not in that sense. In that sense, the economics of the existing legacy eagles probably actually look better even than this, precisely because, you know, they're producing a lot of cash from assets that had a lot of money spent on them 20, 30 years ago, but don't require a lot of money spent on them in the same way, other than money required to do infill drilling and all the rest to keep that decline rate where it is rather than where it could be if that money weren't spent. But to come back to your question, what we're seeing here in terms of the lowest cost developments, yes, these are not unattractive economics. It's when one gets to the higher cost level of things that one starts to see economics that really are not at all attractive.
Senator French and Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's talk about IRR for a second. How far back do you have to go to get a clear picture of IRR with respect to a capital spend? That is, just tell me, how many years does the effect of a capital spend impact IRR?
Senator French, the principal point I was trying to make about IRR is that as a concept, what it measures is an initial spending of capital and then revenues that come as a result. So you have negative cash flow in an initial year or a couple of years and then positive cash flow that come from that. And what you're measuring is the return on that initial capital spending. So in that sense, to get a meaningful IRR for fields that are existing and producing today, one needs to go back to when they were first developed, because that's when the capital was first spent. It's not to say that there aren't other ways of measuring economic value for the existing fields, but IRR as a concept requires the idea of initial development capital and then the revenue that comes from it.
Follow up. But over time, doesn't that initial spend diminish as an impact on IRR?
But for instance, I mean, and Senator French, you can perform this exercise in a few seconds in a spreadsheet. You can't even calculate an IRR unless you have that initial spend.
And so, how do you do that? I mean, is this meant to represent Alaska on this chart? You've got ACEs and you've got a flat profit based tax. So how did you calculate this without knowing all the capital costs of the North Slope?
Senator French, the idea behind this was, I'm not quite sure what's happened here. To move on to the next slide, to take, there's that same red line of the lower cost development and what it looks like compared to the higher costs. The higher cost developments are all, in that sense, representative in some way of some of the costs that we see for higher cost new developments on the slope, whether those be new light oil or more expensive things that we see contemplated both within the existing fields and further out. The idea behind that low-cost light oil line was to say, if we take exactly that same production profile, exactly that same basic spread of capital spending, and instead apply to it lower numbers, more in keeping, for instance, with what we see in terms of averages for the North Slope today, what does that look like? That's not to say that this is a perfect example of the rate of return of the initial investments made by companies 30 years ago. It's simply saying, if one could bring online a new field today with nothing other than the level of capital cost that we see as an average across the North Slope, the economics don't look bad. Where the economics get more challenged is as those costs get up to the $17, $24, $25, $34 barrel level.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What discount rate were you using in these calculations?
And Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I should start adding those to these slides. On the left, the NPV is an NPV 10 figure.
10?
Yeah.
And IRR is 10?
There is no such thing as a discount rate in internal rate of return.
Thank you. And if I could, Mr. Chairman, what's the standard hurdle rate? Well, first of all, I guess, is 10 a reasonable discount rate used by the oil industry? And what is the sort of hurdle rate that we would expect that oil companies would tend to use when computating whether or not to make an investment or not?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. NPV 10 is a very common metric used as a way of measuring economic value. One can get into all sorts of debates as to what is the most appropriate discount rate to use to measure various things. Obviously, for instance, something that is NPV 0 has a net present value of zero at a 10% discount rate, has a 10% rate of return. That's how those two concepts relate to each other. In that sense, just because something reaches NPV 0 here on the left doesn't mean that it's necessarily an attractive proposition if one thinks that one has a hurdle rate of 15% or higher for capital. The other question is, and we've talked a lot about hurdle rates, but hurdle rates are not the only thing that matter here. Hurdle rates are exactly that, an initial hurdle to even get a project considered internally by a company. There's also the question of how those investments compare to a range of other opportunities in the portfolio around the world and how they compete for capital.
Thank you. Please continue, Mr. Mayor. Are we on page 5 now?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. So the idea here was to show that while the economics for the lowest cost production can be not at all unattractive, as one gets to steadily higher and higher cost levels, one gets to places where economics genuinely very challenged and where the progressivity structure of ACES, which does such a good job for the low-cost fields of capturing as much of the economic rent as possible for the state, serves, in the highest cost cases, to significantly increase basic break-even rates at which one achieves, you know, even a 10%, let alone a 15% rate of return on these projects, to very high price levels.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess we go back again to the issue of the credits, because if you have the state picking up at $34 a barrel, half the cost, then you significantly improve the economics.
Senator Wilkowski, these figures are the results of running an actual production profile through the model, and so in that sense they account for the capital credits. They are done on the basis of a standalone project, so this is a producer getting the 25% net operating loss credit, the 20% capital credit, but if one were to do a more complicated exercise and try to look at what this looks like in the context of an existing developer's portfolio, you'd get a slight improvement that comes from not only getting the 25% net operating loss credit, but instead of that, being able to write off at a higher level against existing production. That, as far as I'm concerned, is the only difference there. This is, in that sense, an accurate look of what projects at these price levels would look like to a new developer without an existing production base including claiming those credits. They'd look a lot worse without the credits.
Senator French has a question.
About the costs of projects on the slope, do you get access to the company books? Do they say, here, take a look at a project? You're shaking your head, not nodding, for the record.
Senator French, thank you for the question and the clarification of my gestures. That's correct. I certainly have no access to confidential company information here. I've had informal conversations with a number of the companies, and I think through that have a sense of some of the costs that they're looking at, and I think other members around this table and around the Senate Finance table have had some of those conversations as well and asked in the modeling that we've done for specific costs to be looked at, but I have no access to confidential information that shows specifically what X development or Y development costs.
Follow up.
You know, I had a discussion with the Revenue Commissioner last week about getting access to those numbers, it occurred to me later on that he already has them. They're called the tax returns that the companies file. Each company files a tax return under ACES listing all their expenses, all their costs, and from those tax returns you could probably get a pretty good idea of what the real costs are as opposed to casual conversations with folks that you've had.
Senator French, I'd certainly agree the Department of Revenue has access to a lot of confidential taxpayer information, and if one had access to the information, it would be interesting to do a bunch of analysis on it. The one thing I would say is that simply having access to aggregate costs reported by companies doesn't necessarily tell you a lot about actual development costs of particular different prospects, because one of the things we've talked about a lot here, right, is that there's a big difference between the average versus the particular instance of what goes along with new development. Part of what one is trying to differentiate between here, right, is there's a lot of very profitable investment that the companies are undertaking day after day, year after year, in infield drilling, in well workovers, and a range of things that takes production from a 20 or 15% or whatever the natural decline of a given field is to the sorts of declines that we see today. And that's not a substantial level of capital in terms of the cost that we're seeing. I mean, it's a big investment, but compared to the production that comes from it, it's money very well spent and it's very profitable. And so in that case, just taking an aggregate look at what's a company spending doesn't necessarily tell you, well, if I have a particular plan to drill these 15 horizontal wells into this reservoir that hasn't previously been economic, but technology is just getting to the point that it might be, what are the costs of doing that and what do I need to make that work? That's a very different question, which I suspect you can't answer through the high-level taxpayer data.
If you had access to the individual taxpayer records, as the commissioner does, you could construct a far clearer picture of the economics of the North Slope. Is that right?
Senator French, to the chair, as I say, there's a lot of data there, and it would be interesting to see some further analysis on that. I would still caution that there's a lot that one can't get from that data because it's still at a relatively aggregate level. It's about company, in a given year, what spending did a company report, not, you know, in their development plans when they look at X or Y, new development that requires horizontal drilling or any of the things that are being contemplated at the moment, what are the costs associated with that particular development as opposed to when we lump in together all the things that are being spent on well workovers and infield drilling and other things, what does that cost per barrel produced? Those are very different costs, and unless one can actually get down to that minute level, which at least as far as I haven't seen a company tax return, I don't know exactly the level of detail it goes into, but I would be surprised if it went into that sort of level of detail that would enable one to do that analysis.
A little
briefly, yes.
A little more, I don't mean to hang up on this point, but I guess I can't quite tell what the answer is. If you had access to individual taxpayer records, their billings, their expenditures by all whatever detail it is that they tender to the Department of Revenue, and we've heard in hearings that it's quite voluminous, that it'd be almost impossible to track them because Senator Wilkowski wanted some information gathered, and they kept saying, well, we can't do that because there's too much information. There's tens of hundreds of thousands of lines. So I guess I'm puzzled by your answer, it strikes me, and maybe I'm an uneducated financial person with just the common sense you get from living in the world, I would think that you could construct a far clearer picture of the economics of the North Slope with access to the actual spending of the companies doing business there.
Senator French, through the chair, you may well be right. I think if my answer is less than clear, the short answer is that I don't know enough about what Department of Revenue collects or therefore what one could do with the analysis. I would caution that simply whatever the level of detail available, simply looking at the historical data doesn't necessarily tell you a lot about new developments that are planned and what those cost. And not even planned, but analyzed and may or may not go ahead depending on the economics.
I'll just conclude by, I guess I need more education about this. I'm finding that you're resisting the idea that the actual numbers spent on actual projects on the North Slope would yield a positively concrete information.
Senator French, I think it could quite possibly yield very useful analysis. All I'm suggesting is that whatever is available from that can tell one quite possibly a lot about the historical situation. That could very well be very, very valuable and useful to have. One can't necessarily extrapolate from that to say, therefore, we know everything we need to know about the economics of future projects.
True. Oh, I'll let it go. Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess we can sit here and try to guess and try to figure out what costs were and profits are going to be. Or we can look at the actual profit figures from ConocoPhillips, where we see that total crude oil produced in Alaska was 226 million barrels in the first quarter of 2012. It was 201 million barrels in the lower 48. So very similar amounts of barrels produced. They had a lot more gas produced in the lower 48. But when you look at the profits for ConocoPhillips, ConocoPhillips made $616 million in the state of Alaska this past quarter, $7 million a day, versus $254 million in the lower 48. So I guess we can sit here and try to guess what all these things are going to be, or we can look at the actual numbers, which show that Alaska is an extremely profitable place to do business. Would you disagree with that?
Senator Wilikowski, in terms of the existing base portfolio for the companies that are here, I would certainly not disagree with the idea that, and again, Conoco is the best example because they report Alaska separately and one can actually tell in that sense exactly what they make here versus in other parts of the world. Alaska is a very profitable region for ConocoPhillips today. Particularly, if one is drawing the comparison with the lower 48, there are a number of reasons for that, and as you correctly point out, part of that is the fact that the lower 48 is largely, their production there is gas with a very low sale price, as opposed to oil with a relatively high sale price here at the moment. But and yes, on the one hand, they have significantly higher net income per barrel. I think they, if my recollection from the last time I looked at Conoco Financials is right, I think about $25 a barrel is what they make in terms of net income per barrel up here, higher than what they see in the lower 48. One can then ask the question, so why are they investing lots of money in the lower 48 and not up here, right? Because if one also looks at those same financials at actual capital spend up here versus capital spend in the lower 48, I think what one sees, and again, this is off the top of my head, about $500 million in 2011, in capital spend in Alaska, a bit over $4 billion in capital spend in the lower 48. Is ConocoPhillips some bizarre, irrational investor that is putting all its money in the place that it gets the lowest profits? Well, no. What one has to understand is the fundamental difference in that sense between the base portfolio here, the base portfolio in the lower 48, and then the analysis of what new opportunities in each place look like. This is a highly profitable current day producing region for ConocoPhillips precisely because they made large investments 20, 30 years ago that have fully depreciated. They need to spend a certain amount of money maintaining their capital, a certain amount of money on well workovers and infield drilling and all those things that keep production from being a very steep decline to a shallower decline. And that's all money very profitably spent. And it's a significant producer of cash for ConocoPhillips. That question is a very different question to say, well, what's the next thing that the Conoco or any other companies up here could be doing to produce additional production? What do the economics of those things look like? And so one of the things that I've tried to differentiate between in presenting this analysis, both in Senate Resources and Senate Finance Committee, is saying there's a lot that one probably needs to do on the fiscal terms to incentivize some of that highest cost new development. And there are a number of ways in which one can do it, and in some of the coming slides we'll look at this in more detail. One way is to try to specifically target that incentive to higher cost new production, whether that's, for instance, specifically limiting it only to new areas, whether that's trying to draw some sort of decline curve or find some other way through the regulatory process to say, okay, this is an approved new development that would have a lower rate of tax. The alternative is to say we're going to lower government take across the board. Lowering government take across the board is a simple way of doing things. It has less distortions, but it involves giving a lot of cash back to companies for activities that are economically profitable today, and the Conoco earnings figures you cite are evidence of that. The fact that all the investment that we see that goes on in the slope today goes on is evidence of the fact that that is profitable investment today. So there's a fundamental choice to be made in that sense between tax reform that is about trying to provide incentive for higher cost new developments, including in the legacy fields where the biggest impact is to be had, and doing that in a way that tries, however imperfectly, to differentiate between that legacy production versus new production that could come online, and trying to find ways to stimulate that, bearing in mind that there are a lot of imperfections in doing that, that, you know, for instance, and we've talked a lot, particularly at Senate Finance, about this question of a decline curve and having a lower rate on production above that decline. There are a number of problems that come with that, including, for instance, if I'm a producer below my target, do I run my economics at the above the decline curve rate, or do I run it on a conservative basis because I'm not sure that it's going to get me there at the lower rate? And so, you know, there are costs and trade-offs to each of these things, but there's that fundamental choice of, on the one hand, taking a simple approach that has the least possibilities for unintended consequences, for perverse incentives, but moves a lot of cash back to companies for currently highly economic activities, or a more complicated approach that has greater risk of some of those adverse and unintended consequences, but seeks to limit the cash that's moved back to companies for highly economic activities today, while still providing some sort of incentive for new incremental production out of the legacy fields.
Mr. Mayor, you know, slide 5 talks about project value, and we've been discussing, you know, one aspect of Alaska's money structure and dealing with the industry. And you know, we've learned over the last months or so that North Dakota and Texas, their royalty is 25% to 30%. You know, these are the commercially reasonable royalties that are being assessed in North Dakota and Texas. You know, as a hypothetical, if Alaska's resource were physically located in either North Dakota or Texas, would you expect that Alaska, for its resource as an owner state, would receive royalty of 25 or 30% or more?
Senator Pascavan, I'm not sure I entirely understand the question, but I mean, as a resource owner at the moment, the state of Alaska gets significantly more than that in terms of total government take than...
Well, my question is, you know, right now we hear that North Dakota and Texas are receiving 25 and 30% royalties. The question is that if Alaska's resource were located in those jurisdictions, would the resource owner, if they owned Alaska's resource, would they be getting 25 or 30% royalty in those jurisdictions?
Mr. Chair, one of the things I've shown a number of times on the screen previously is this sort of benchmarking exercise of where does the state of Alaska compare to some of those jurisdictions. And what we've tried to use are average royalty rates applying in those places, including private landholder royalties. Certainly in some places you do get royalties up into the 20s. Quite possibly there have been recent contracts for particularly attractive leases that get higher than that, even up to 30%. we try to use an average, because simply taking the highest that one sees isn't necessarily representative either. But when one compares that to the total government take one sees in Alaska, particularly at $100 a barrel and above, Alaska may structure the way it takes its share as a resource owner differently to the way resource owners in North Dakota or Texas or wherever else do, but the overall take that it's getting is significantly higher. Now, if Alaska were geographically located in the lower 48 with its quality of resources, quite possibly, it's an attractive resource base, and if you took away some of the difficulties that come from geography and climate and a whole range of other things up here, it only gets more attractive. But we're already talking about a level of take for the resource that's higher than the level that you're talking about for some of those royalties in those regimes.
Isn't it, so to speak, the fiduciary duty of elected officials in Alaska to try to behave like a sophisticated owner of a world-class resource?
Without any question, Mr. Chair, of course it is.
Any further questions before we go into seeing none? We'll go to the next page.
To come back briefly to conclude then on, and this is a series of conclusions we've discussed before, both at Senate Resources and Senate Finance, that if what one wants is, if one's basic outlook on this is that there is a given amount of production to come, particularly from the legacy fields in Alaska, that there isn't a lot that can be done to significantly increase that, and that what one wants is to ride that out into the sunset, to harvest as much of that cash as possible for the state of Alaska. If the basic assumption is that these are assets that are in harvest mode and as much of that cash as possible should come to the state of Alaska, ACES is a very effective regime to do that. It does that very well. There's a lot of existing capital work required to go from a 20, 15, 12, whatever the fundamental underlying decline in some of these fields is, to the decline that we see today. Through the capital credits, through all those things, ACES provides good incentive to do that work, to keep that work very economic, while having a very high level of government take and ensuring that as much of the upside, particularly of high oil price environments, comes as possible to the state. ACES does all of that very well.
And Mr. Mayor, so that the viewing public understands, Alaska went into harvest mode as far as its legacy fields many years before the current tax structure was created.
Mr. Chair, I, broadly speaking, I'd agree. I think there's always some differentiation over semantics of exactly what one means by harvest mode, but I think certainly under the definition that the PFC applies to these things, Alaska has been, broadly speaking, in harvest mode for some time and before ACES ever went into place. The suggestion here is not that somehow ACES has created this situation. It's that if that was the situation at the time ACES was introduced, if that's the basic assessment, then this is a good regime for that system. If one thinks that there is actually significant new production that could come out of the legacy fields, out of new areas, what it doesn't do a good job of is providing attractive economics to enable those investments to happen.
Mr. Mayor, we've heard with respect to a potential $5 billion being invested in the legacy fields over the next 5 to 10 years. Is that consistent within the legacy fields staying in a harvest mode?
Mr. Chair, that's certainly a significant new investment. I think what you've heard is companies talk about specific plans that are on their books that they've looked at in the current environment that struggle in their economics but that are contemplated in terms of going forward. I think what one would eventually hope from some form of tax reform, however it was structured, was that one would get that investment, and then if one had in place a tax system that at least for incremental production out of the legacy fields genuinely did provide attractive economics for a range of higher cost new opportunities, that meant that companies then opened up their books and said, oh, well, here are a range of other options that we can now actually start running some analysis on that we haven't even looked at yet, because the opportunities that we have in front of us, we can't get capital from corporate headquarters on as it is. So I think talking solely in terms of particular commitments made by companies gives us a very limited set to work with, because by definition companies aren't going to come forward and say, oh yes, over the next 10, 20 years these are all the things that we want to do, because there are a lot of opportunities here that they haven't even looked at.
Well, essentially, I guess, is the $5 billion consistent with debottlenecking procedures which are consistent with remaining in a harvest mode?
Mr. Chair, I'd need to look in more detail at the specific plans to comment on that. But in general, what I've seen described as significant investments in new capital that were they made, certainly could potentially alter the question of how we would designate something in terms of harvest versus focus. But it's a very hypothetical discussion at this point, and I simply don't know enough at this point as to what investments might be made and at what point one would get to a point to say, okay, this is really no longer for any given company a harvest regime. This is actually returning to the core of their activity.
You know, in the last 10 years or so, how many exploration wells have been drilled by the majors in the North Slope?
Without the data in front of me, Mr. Chair, it's not a question I can answer off the top of my head.
I didn't hear that.
Mr. Chair, off the top of my head, without the data in front of me, I can't give you a specific number of wells.
Is the lack of exploration wells being drilled in the Central North Slope an indication that a field is in harvest mode?
Mr. Chair, that by itself not particularly. I mean, in the Central North Slope, I wouldn't expect to see a huge amount of exploration wells. These are largely well-defined assets that are well understood by the companies. The question is probably more about development wells that are being drilled than exploration.
And then, you know, we've heard information with respect to the last major treatment facility having been built. The GHX2 was completed in 1995. Is the fact that the last major treatment facility was constructed in 1995, is that consistent with a region, meaning the legacy fields, being in harvest mode and staying in harvest mode?
Mr. Chair, one can point to any given number of individual data points. I think the overall analysis that we take when looking at a company, and we look at companies' global portfolios and categorize them in a range of ways, there are a number of things we look at. One is the sheer level of investment that goes on versus the cash that a region produces. Another is the role of that region in the future announced spending plans of a company. And on that basis, I think a number of companies would disagree with the idea that they're in harvest mode, because they look at the substantial amounts of cash that they put in today. We, when we do our global analysis of companies' portfolios, say that by and large for the majors, particularly if one looks just at the North Slope, that Alaska is a harvest jurisdiction for them, precisely because of the significant income they get from it, the relatively limited investment that's required to maintain that, and what we see at the moment being relatively limited future spending plans. Were those to change, then how we view that could change, but that's how we view things at the moment.
I guess one last question, and then we'll allow some other questions by committee members. But, you know, when one looks at the treatment facilities and you know, is the TAPS throughput a result of the throughput of the treatment facilities on the Central North Slope?
Mr. Chair, it's a very technical question that I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer. I think you've probably already heard testimony from some of the folks at the Department of Natural Resources specifically about limitations of facilities and how much they, as opposed to underlying issues in the production from the fields, are responsible for decline. So I would suggest that some of the technical experts that you already have in the regulatory agencies are the best place to answer the question of how much facilities are the particular limiting factor.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your statement, ACES inhibits the development of new projects and resources that might help stem or even reverse the decline. Are you aware of how many companies were doing business in Alaska before ACES and how many companies are doing business now?
Senator Wilikowski, off the top of my head, I don't have those numbers. I imagine what you're about to say is that there are significantly more today. Is that correct?
There's a 253% increase in the number of oil companies filing tax returns. It's gone from 18 to about 63. Companies like Link, Repsol, Great Bear, Royale. Would a 253% increase in the number of companies doing business in Alaska seem to indicate to you that our tax structure inhibits development?
Senator Wilikowski, for the chair, it's an excellent question. What I would point to is that I suspect a lot of those companies are here precisely for one aspect of the ACES system, and that is the generous credits it allows for exploration. One of the, we've looked in some detailed testimony at Senate Finance before the question of how that credit works and the incentives that it provides. In general, our analysis was that absolutely it creates a significant incentive to bring new players up here to undertake exploration activity, but that there are a couple of problems with that. One, that the level of support is high enough that in lots of ways the activity being encouraged, and we've seen other jurisdictions where this has happened previously. My colleague Tony Reich gave the example of Canada with its new energy policy, I believe in the 80s and the 90s, where the incentive is such that one encourages a lot of activity that are more about claiming the credit than they are necessarily about what one eventually finds. And a lot of speculative activity about drilling up some holes to then be able to hopefully sell on a lease to another operator at a profit, as opposed to activity that's aimed at long-term development plans. A lot of activity by companies that probably wouldn't be capable of bringing a lot of production, an asset to production, were they successful in their exploration. So, and at the same time, for instance, a lot of that activity takes, you know, at the moment there are a limited number of rigs in Alaska. Some of that activity takes rigs that would otherwise be used to be doing development work on the North Slope and puts them to work drilling up more or less prospective areas precisely because that's what the high level of exploration credit encourages. So yes, I think there's no question that the exploration credit in particular has encouraged involvement by a lot of smaller companies to do a lot of drilling. What the long run economic value of that to the state of Alaska is remains an open-ended question.
Senator French has a question.
Do we have a working definition of harvest mode? It's a term we throw around a lot, and I'm just wondering if we can kind of condense it down to a sentence or two, just so we are all sort of on the same page when we use that phrase.
Senator French, broadly speaking, I'd say it's a region where that is a net cash producer for a company, not a net investment region, that is no longer at a given point in time a significant new focus for the company in terms of new investments. That is a part of a company's portfolio that is more about the base production and the revenue that comes from that and what that can be used to do elsewhere in the portfolio, as opposed to a significant focus of new investment activity.
And if I could follow up, and is that in part, two points. One, I think your analysis is buttressed by a 1994 memo, a BP memo that we saw in an earlier hearing about the length of the life of the pipeline. Did you ever get a copy of that memo? Did Senator Passman ever show it to you?
I'm not aware that I've seen that memo, Senator.
It was a 1994 memo that basically said Alaska, for BP, Alaska is a place to make money and ship it somewhere else and invest.
And Senator French, that's a natural part of the economic cycle of oil and gas development as well. You know, the oil and gas fields here in Alaska were similarly developed with cash that came from other regions, including, you know, the North Sea at the time. One invests large amounts of capital in a given area, has a significant cash deficit for some period of time, then later on one extracts that cash. There may then be later times when one can come back to those assets and find new, more difficult, higher cost opportunities to invest. But it's a cycle of there is no natural state of things where cash produced in one place should always stay there. It's a cycle for any large company around the world of investing in one place while using profits from previous investments to finance that. That's how global oil and gas portfolios work.
And so here we are 18 years later after that memo was written, and we're probably still in the same mode, producing cash to be invested somewhere else.
Broadly speaking, Senator French, I wouldn't disagree with that. I would simply add that there are a range of investment possibilities that don't have very attractive economics that could potentially change that.
Sure. And I guess that's I'm leading up towards the idea, and I asked the revenue commissioner last week this. Of course, he works for the governor. I'm going to ask you now. You work for us. What I'm trying to do is get some apples-to-apples comparisons about aging conventional reservoirs. That's what Kuparuk is. That's what Prudhoe is. That's where all the gold is for the state. And so I'm wondering, you know, how, if there's an example of one of those aging conventional reservoirs around the globe, ones that you might be more familiar with than I am, where, you know, a small tax change, a reasonable tax change, has produced sort of a turnaround in that reservoir out of the harvest mode into a more thriving investment climate. That would be of great value to me as I decide what to do here, because I'm afraid that a small tax change just means that more Alaska money goes to work somewhere else around the globe, and that's a tragedy from my perspective.
Senator French, there are a couple of examples that occur to me, but rather than go into that now, I would suggest, you know, quite possibly give a slightly longer presentation on exactly that issue in the near-term future.
And should I run this through Chair Hawker, or will you go to Chair Hawker and say, you know, Senator French has posed a really brilliant question I want to work on?
I'm sure together we can discuss that with the chair of LBNA, and we presented previous analysis to Senate Finance, for instance, on things like, you know, what did British Columbia look like. We've, I think, presented a little bit of analysis before, for instance, on some of the turnaround that occurred in things like the Forties field in the UK. They're more about a change of operator and about technology than about the fiscal structure. But there are a number of things that we could look at.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Mayor, continuing on page 6, you know, one of the portions of this that is doesn't seem to ring true to me is the statement that ACES is not progressive with regard to costs. You know, isn't it true that as costs go up, that Alaska's deductibility of those costs also goes up? And with respect to the capital expenditures, if those capital expenditures go up, both the deductibility and the credit go up. So doesn't the current structure take into consideration both increase in operating expenditures and increase in capital expenditures?
Mr. Chair, it's an excellent question. If one were to look just at the production tax by itself, and for instance, look at it in isolation without looking at the capital credits, one would have a system that's relatively neutral with regard to costs. The capital credits add some element of cost progressivity, but then there are also other elements of the regime, including that 12.5% odd fixed royalty that's a highly regressive element of the regime. What I see when I put all these things together and run economics at different costs through the model is that not only does the overall rate of government take not decrease as costs go up, it either stays flat or slightly increases. So that's the basis for saying that it's not progressive with regard to costs, and that high-cost projects, despite all those things, still face very high levels of government take.
By that, are you saying jurisdictions that have royalty rates of 25 or 30% are highly regressive?
That's absolutely true. And one of the things that's apparent in looking at some of those sort of benchmarking slides that we've shown certainly this table a number of times before, when one looks at some of those fixed royalty regimes, at very low prices, particularly the higher cost producing assets, some of the unconventionals, actually look pretty bad. It's at $40 and below. When one gets to where we are in the current day in terms of price environments and anywhere above, though it's the highly price progressive nature of ACEs versus the regressive nature of those regimes that means that they are very competitive at today's prices, particularly given their cost structure, because they have still, even in the case of the unconventionals, a not outrageously high cost structure. They have very high oil prices and a regressive regime that means that under high oil prices there's very low government take. That's not necessarily how one would ideally design a fiscal structure, but it does make it very competitive in the current price environment.
So is it a more complete statement to make that under Alaska's current cost structure, at high prices given relatively low costs, that there may be a taking away of some upside potential? In other words, the rate of progressivity magnifies itself when one has high costs with a relatively, or excuse me, when one has high oil pricing combined with a relatively low-cost operation.
Mr. Chair, in Alaska, I think most of what I'm trying to say is that the system really doesn't change that much with regard to cost. Whether one has a low-cost or a high-cost project, one faces pretty similar levels of government take. It may be slightly worse in the higher-cost case, but it's not a dramatic difference. But it's not a regime where, for instance, and there are only a few of these in the world, but there are some, where government take actually falls as costs go up. And unless government take falls in high-cost cases, by definition, some of those high-cost developments will not have very attractive economics because they're already challenged in the first place, and then high government take on top of that is what makes them economically undesirable.
I believe Senator Wilikowski had a question.
I do. It's a little bit complicated, Mr. Chairman, but I'm trying to get at this issue of how much the state really participates. And maybe I can meet with Mr. Janik later and sort of go through this with him. But if you have a producer that produces just, for example, 25 million barrels in a year with an average production tax value of $80, total production tax value is $2 billion, tax rate of 45% equals taxes paid of $900 million. If a producer then decides to spend $100 million on a new capital project that will result in future production, they reduce their production tax value from $2 billion to $1.9 billion, which drops their per barrel PTV from 80 to 76, which drops their tax rate to 43.4%, which drops their taxes paid from $900 million to $824 million, less a $20 million capital credit for spending the $100 million. You have net taxes paid dropping from $900 million to $804 million, $600,000, which on a $100 million investment results in an immediate tax savings of $95.4 million or state participation of over 95%. I don't know if you were able to follow that. Is that correct?
Senator Wilkowski, I can't comment on the details of the math. The basic concepts behind it certainly ring true to me. I need to look at the details of the math to look at the figures you quote. Certainly, particularly when it comes to things like the 40% exploration credit, we've presented analysis before that shows very high levels of state support. We've similarly commented in the past that some of those high levels of support are, if nothing else, not a strong incentive to maintain solid cost controls in some respects, that if implicitly on an after-tax cash flow basis, a lot of what one is spending comes off in terms of tax deduction or tax credits, that one may be tempted to spend on desirable rather than essential things. It's a, you know, widely commented on phenomenon known as gold plating, and we've commented on that before. But I'd want to work through the details of your math before.
And do I need to go through the chairman, who then needs to go through LBNA, who then needs to go to you, who then needs to go back to the LBNA, to then the chairman back to me, or can I just talk to you directly?
Mr. Wilikowski, Senator Wilikowski, if you'd like to show me your calculations after this, I'm more than happy to have a look at them. And if there is any significant analysis that needs to be undertaken on that basis, then I'm sure we can discuss that with the chair of LBNA.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I mean, does that sound about roughly correct, that the state participation would be 95%?
If if one is looking at, on a marginal basis, the impact of an after-tax dollar spent on a given development, I can believe it can be high. I don't know if it's as high as that or not, but I'd want to check. Off the top of my head, I think there is, and again, I'd want to sit down and do the modeling on this, there's a significant difference between that versus thinking about that as state participation. But I'd like to sit down and present a couple of examples of why that's the case, if I could.
Mr. Mayor, one of the other comments that I'm trying to struggle with at the moment, you know, there has not been one complete year under the ACES system that's been audited. And so while we know that the trend for capital expenditures has been up and it's forecasted on the trend to continue to go up, how can you say that it's inhibiting, so to speak, new production spending? In other words, if there's not been an audit, but capital expenditures are increasing and we have more operators coming to Alaska than ever before, it appears to be a very maybe overly broad statement that you're making.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I'd agree. I'd say, regardless of any of those facts, we know a few things. We know that there is very limited new investment in actually bringing online significant new production. We've certainly seen spending on, you know, all the things we've talked about before, whether it's well workovers, whether it's infield drilling, and in particular significant volumes of spending on the maintenance that needs to go into assets that were built 20, 30 years ago and have reached the end of their productive life and need to be renewed. But we haven't seen significant spending, particularly since ACES was in place, on bringing in line significant new production. And not only that, but when one runs the economics of new projects at any of the price levels we've been talking about, they don't look very attractive.
You know, I don't want to be argumentative, but, you know, we have examples such as BP is spending a lot of money in its heavy oil and viscous oil, and that is for new oil production. We have ConocoPhillips is in its CD5 and Greater Moose's Tooth and these other projects. We have Pioneer, we have ENI, we have all of these operations that are coming in, and maybe they're not all producing yet, but there's been significant capital expenditure and operating expenditures in the last 4 or 5 or 6 years. What rings true and what doesn't?
Mr. Chair, I mean, you raise a number of examples there. Pioneer, I think, is a particularly good one, right, of a company that made a series of investment decisions before ACES, and if I'm correct, before even PPT was put into place, ran their economics on that basis and then had significantly higher taxes put on the result. I have at least some sense of what the economics of that project looks like. And all I'd say is the state of Alaska has made it very difficult for them to make a good return on that project. I think, you know, they have a number of, and any number of the companies have a number of future prospects that they would like to look at. But a lot of the examples that you give are examples of things that either reached sanction before ACES was put into place, or were the function of a long series of planning before that time. Undoubtedly, there has been significant new spending during the time that ACES has been around. Some of that has been very economic under ACES, but in terms of high-cost new developments, really not so much.
Mr. Mayor, if we could interject, and you know, I know that we were planning on having a Senate floor session at 11 o'clock and possibly we've been going for about 2 hours now, and I know we could continue with PFC after floor session, and so is there a Senator Stevens?
Mr. Chair, we'll just simply change that to the floor session at call of the chair. There's nothing on the calendar right now, so we'll just have a technical session. So please continue as long as you feel proper.
All right. Thank you. We've been going at this for almost 2 hours now. I believe it'd probably be appropriate to have a at ease at the moment, so we'll go in at ease. We will reconvene Senate Resources. Mr. Mayor, one of the observations that was made, it would probably be useful going back to page 3, is if there could be some attempt to appropriately modify that chart to reflect the credits and the deductions, and I don't know if that can reasonably be done, but to give a better sense of reality, and is that something that could reasonably be accomplished?
Mr. Chair, I can look into that. I'm wary at the outset because, as I say, I think if one's going to factor in credits and deductions, then those are parts of the fiscal system, and one also then needs to be looking at the other side of that, which is what gets taken out on the revenue side. So the point of that slide was to talk about the difference in actual costs for development, which stands. I'm more than happy to try to get into some other form of analysis to look at the question of effective levels of support for spending, both through write-off of costs and through credits. I'm not sure that slide is the best way to do that, but I'm more than happy to give some thought as to how one might drill down into that question. And that also, I think, goes back to the question that Senator Wilkowski was asking me, which I'm more than happy to look into a bit more detail.
Yeah, I believe that'd be appropriate so that there's a clear understanding of what the net, so to speak, that the company is expending and what portion of those expenses the state of Alaska is supporting.
That is certainly a topic, Mr. Chair, that I'd be very happy to look at in more detail.
And for purposes of the committee's understanding, Mr. Mayor is unavailable this afternoon, so you will be here until noon, and then we'll have to take a break. As I understand, you're starting at 1 o'clock this afternoon elsewhere.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
So please continue, Mr. Mayor.
To take those basic conclusions about the nature of the ACES regime, that is to say, it works very well as a regime for a harvest area in terms of maximizing cash to the state of Alaska, but isn't very good at incentivizing new, particularly high-cost developments. The question is, well, what are the options then that one can undertake to spur new developments? Now, there are a couple of ways in which one can do that. In particular, the biggest question that one needs to grapple with from a policy perspective is the question of, does one take an approach of uniformly lowering government take, or does one seek instead to differentiate in some ways between old and new production? There are costs and benefits to both approaches. In terms of uniformly lowering government take, one doesn't need to add any increased complexity into the system. There are potentially even opportunities for simplification of the existing fiscal regime. There also are significantly less possibilities for distortion, for unanticipated consequences that come from trying to get into the question of differentiating between old and new. But there is a major cost that comes with that approach. It's the approach, of course, that Senate Bill 3001 takes, and that is that by doing so, by providing something that significantly improves economics for some of the new production, one is also inherently moving back a lot of cash to the existing producers for activity that today is very economic, very profitable, as Senator Wilkowski pointed out in his reference to the Conoco financials. So if one doesn't want to do that, then the only way of providing significant incentive for new production is to find some way of differentiating between the old and the new production. Now, when it comes to completely new areas, that's relatively easy to do. One can simply do and Senate Bill 3001 does this to some extent, define new production as coming from completely new areas that are not currently in production. Those are easy to define. One can relatively easily set specific terms for those areas that provide a significant incentive for development from those areas. But by far the greatest impact is to be had by new things that could be developed in the legacy fields, simply reducing by a percentage point the decline of any of the current fields is going to have a much greater impact on production, particularly over the next decade, than anything that's currently being considered in terms of new production from completely new areas. So in terms of how one goes about doing that, there are a range of ways, and this again is a discussion that's been had in the Senate over the last many weeks, in terms of either providing some degree of discretion to, through the regulatory process, to the relevant agencies to develop, to define particular new projects as qualifying for a particular low rate, or trying to define some sort of decline curve, whether at a company average level, or try to get to what I think one ideally would like to do, which is look asset by asset and at the most granular level possible, and have expert staff, either in the Department of Natural Resources or consultants, brought in to actually try to fit a curve to each of those assets and look at what they would be in the future. And one can do that either on the basis of what that decline is with no spending, what that decline is with the current sort of level of spending that, as we've seen, is economic under the current regime. There are a number of ways one could cut that, and then seeking to incentivize production above that level. So there are a number of ways one could do that. It puts in place greater complexity. There are a number of potential unintended consequences from doing that. I think perhaps the most concerning is the question of, if I'm a producer with some sort of decline-based target that I need to reach, and I'm underneath that at the moment, and I have X new project that could get me above that, if I'm uncertain about the prospect of this project, if I'm uncertain that it's really going to get me there, then chances are I will run the economics at the existing base rate rather than the new preferential rate. So there are a number of imperfections with that option too, but in that sense, the point of the slide is that there are no perfect options to spur new developments. One either takes the surefire approach, but also hands back a lot of cash to companies for existing economic activities, or one does something that's much less perfect, but also restricts the amount of cash that's put back to companies for current economic activities. One can, and there's been a lot of discussion about the sort of cost support under ACES as it is, try to enhance those further as one aspect of this. The only thing I'd say is, I mean, one of the things that we've discussed is that those also actually create their own series of perverse incentives in terms of particular, lack of incentives for good cost control that are not necessarily desirable. And in that regard, I think that is that third option is in many ways the most fraught option. If one looks at how these apply in the case of Senate Bill 3001, overall, the most significant part of Senate Bill 3001 is the question of taking that approach of basically uniform lowering a government take through the 40% gross revenue allowance that it applies across the North Slope. It does differentiate for completely new areas as well by providing a greater incentive for completely new areas, but that's not this concept in that sense of trying to differentiate between increased production out of the legacy fields versus incremental production out of those fields. It's simply completely new areas have the most generous treatment, and then everything else has a significant reduction in government take. It also does one thing in the third category, which is, in terms of that question of greater uplift for costs, taking that 40% well credit that at the moment applies outside the North Slope and applying it in the North Slope, and we'll look at the impact of some of that as well in the analysis here. I imagine, having had a number of sessions of testimony from the administration on this, the committee is reasonably familiar with the main aspects of the bill at this point, but to run over them very, very briefly, the key points are that for completely new areas, a 30% gross revenue exclusion, which applies both to the calculation of the base tax and the progressive tax amounts, though it doesn't apply to the actual progressivity rate calculation. and that applies for 10 years. For all other North Slope production, there's then that 40% gross revenue exclusion, so it's a higher rate, but it applies only to the progressive tax amount. It doesn't apply to the calculation of, the, of that base 25% tax, or again, to the rate calculation of the progressivity rate, and that applies indefinitely. The other important features, of course, are capping progressivity, reducing it from 75 to 60%, then, as I was mentioning, that 40% well lease expenditure credit previously for areas outside the North Slope now applied to the North Slope, and finally changing the time period in which capital credits can be redeemed rather than spreading them over 2 years, having them over the single year. Briefly, to work through the math of how those gross revenue exclusions work, what we have here is sort of taking the basic sort of format the Department of Revenue uses in the Revenue Sources Handbook for showing the calculations that occur at a high level, viewing the North Slope all in aggregate under RACES, starting out, of course, with about $22 billion worth of total annual production, subtracting out $3.3 billion in royalty or other federal barrels, for instance, ending up with about $18.84 billion in taxable barrels, subtracting away $1.4 billion in transportation costs and getting to a gross value of the point of production based on their 2013 forecast of $17.4 billion. That's common to ACES as well as to anything contemplated in SB 3001, either for existing or for new production. Again, total lease expenditures then of just over $5 billion, meaning an initial calculation of production tax value in all these regimes of $12.3 billion. Now, the differences between ACES and SB 3001 come from here. Under ACES, that $12.385 billion is what's used in calculating. If it's divided by all the taxable barrels, it's what gives a production tax value of $71.80, which is then what the progressive tax rate is calculated on. That $12,385 is multiplied by 25% to give a base production tax amount of $3 billion. That same $12.385 billion is multiplied then by 16.72%, which is the progressive tax amount at the forecast FY 2013 DOR price of $109.47 a barrel to give a progressive tax amount of just over $2 billion for a total production tax before credits of $5.1 billion. The way the gross revenue exclusion contemplated under SB 301 works is the base tax is similarly levied on that PTV production tax value of 12.385, so it has exactly the same base tax amount of $3.9096 billion. But the base on which the progressive tax is levied is reduced by 40% of that gross value at the point of production. So it comes down from $12.385 billion to only $5.4 billion to yield less than it.
Chairman, just right there, I just need a little help. You're saying it's reduced by 40% of the production tax value, so it'd be 40% of $12 billion?
Senator French, it's reduced by 40% of the gross value of point of production, so 40% of $17 billion.
Ah, okay, 40% of 17.4.
Yes.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
The numbers in red on that slide are where there's a difference from the ACES regime in terms of calculation of the base and the numbers in blue than in terms of calculation of the actual tax. So that's the colouring there is to show where there is a difference. So in that case, the base on which the progressive tax is levied is no longer under Senate Bill 3001, $12.3 billion, it's instead $5.4 billion, and so the actual progressive tax paid under Senate Bill 3001 isn't the $2 billion paid under ACES, it's under $1 billion, about $900 million. Leading to a total tax liability before the credits of only $4 billion, so about $1.1 and $1.2 billion less than under ACES. There's then an increased impact of the credits, in particular because of the 40% credit for well work. I think this assumption here is based on Department of Revenue figures, but My own modeling assumed, I think, 40% of capital credits being eligible for the well credit and produced a similar number to the number that they've used here. So when includes the impact of that as well as a once-off impact, which is essentially just a once-off phasing impact of credits being claimed over 2 years versus credits being claimed over 1 year, you have that couple hundred million dollars in difference on the credits, and that's where you get the difference of 4.7 versus 3.2 billion in revenue to the state in 2003 from those two systems. The column on the right, I've included the same calculations to show how they work under Senate Bill 3001 for new fields as well. One can't extrapolate anything particularly meaningful from the bottom line there of 2.2 billion because the only way that that means anything is if that rate were applied to oil production in 2013. Of course, the basic idea, particularly the way that's set out, is that would apply to exactly no production in 2013. So it doesn't have an impact. It's simply laid out there to make it clear how those calculations work. And, of course, the difference here is, on the one hand, the gross revenue allowance is less. It's 30% rather than 40%. But crucially, it applies to both the base tax and the progressive tax. So where the base tax under 3001 for existing production was still being levied off that 12.3 billion amount, under 3001 for new fields, it's instead levied off 7.1 billion, which is the same amount that the progressive tax is levied off. So the base tax for new fields is lower, the progressive tax is higher, but the overall amount paid for new production is substantially lower than it is for existing production under 3001.
Senator French has a question, but just so that the listening audience is clear, these are just showing the application of the system to numbers, not that it would apply to these dollars on the existing legacy fields, for example.
That is exactly correct, Mr. Chair. The Senate Bill 3001 for new fields should basically apply to exactly no production in 2013. This is that third column has no impact in terms of actual revenue to the state in 2013. It's simply provided to show how the numbers work.
Thank you. Senator French.
Just another word or two on that. It would apply to new shale oil developments because they're outside of existing units. Is that right?
If those developments were actually to reach production in 2013, then yes, that would apply to them.
Or in 2014 or in 2015.
Yes, right. That's correct.
But this would not apply to heavy oil developed within, say, Prudhoe or Kuparuk. That would be the 3001 existing.
That's correct. All of those existing areas under 3001 are taxed at the rate implied by that middle column.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue, Mr. Mayor.
Now, one thing I thought was worth discussing is the question of what's the purpose of this gross revenue exclusion concept? To me, the purpose of a gross revenue exclusion concept is what it enables one to do in terms of differentiating in terms of production tax rates under the existing ACES structure. The ACES production tax is, of course, as we all know, a profit-based tax. It taxes wellhead revenue net of costs. And under that structure, precisely because it's all based on revenue net of costs, it's very difficult to vary either the base or the progressive rates for some production stream and not for others. The only way to do that, if you're actually going to change the tax rates, is to then introduce this concept of ring fencing and suggesting that we're going to account completely separately for costs from different streams of production, whatever they are, whether those are completely new areas, whether those are base production versus incremental production above some sort of decline curve. However one cuts it, one would then need to be able to track costs to each of those different streams of production. The alternative in terms of ways of reducing government take for particular streams of production, if one is trying to avoid all that complexity, really the only way of doing that in the existing structure of ACES is this idea of some sort of gross revenue exclusion concept, where because it's calculated on the gross revenue, because it has nothing to do with costs, it's an easy way of providing some sort of allowance to say, okay, this is a way of reducing government take for a particular stream and not for others. We're not going to change the way progressivity works. We're not going to change the way any of those rate calculations work. We don't have to, therefore, account for costs for different streams separately. We can simply take this number, which comes from the gross revenues that came from that production stream. All we need to know was what was produced and what price was it, and apply that to a producer's overall production tax liability at the end and reduce their tax liability accordingly. It's a way that one can essentially replicate the economics of a change in the progressive tax rate or the base tax rate for a particular project, for a particular type of project, without having to get into the whole question of ring fencing.
Senator French has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let's just focus on the Prudhoe and Kuparuk reservoirs. The governor's bill simply reduces taxes on all that oil, and we have been thinking about ways of trying to reward performance, and one of the ways we talked about doing that was with respect to oil that beats the decline curve. We got close to something like that in 192. You could use the gross revenue exclusion to reward oil that beats the decline curve, is that right?
That is certainly correct, Senator French.
And what about for heavy oil? Could you count the barrels of heavy oil that come out of the ground and provide a gross revenue exclusion just for that heavy oil?
Yes, you could certainly do that, and one could do that, for instance, at a greater rate than one applied to others because of its higher costs.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So that's the basic idea behind the gross revenue exclusion concept is it's something that makes it possible to differentiate between some of those streams and provide particular incentives for the most challenged production streams without having to get into this whole question of ring-fencing assets and accounting for their costs separately. So what's interesting to me in that sense about Senate Bill 3001 is that they take that basic concept, which really only makes sense if one is trying to use it to distinguish between production streams, and use it to lower government take across the board. It seems to me in that sense that, given the basic economics of the way that works is simply to reduce progressivity on the base production because it only applies to the progressive tax, one could achieve something certainly very similar simply by reducing progressivity under the base tax and do it simply and more transparently. I haven't spent a lot of time in calculations on this, but I think it's from the brief look I've had, it's an approximately equivalent that the 40% gross revenue exclusion on the progressive tax is approximately equivalent to reducing progressivity from about 0.4 to 0.15. If what one wants is to reduce the government take across the board on everything, it seems to me easier and more straightforward to do it through the instrument itself, i.e. in this case the progressive rate, rather than through the gross revenue exclusion. The gross revenue exclusion to me makes most sense where it's used specifically to target particular production streams, whether that's production above a decline curve, whether that's oil with a particular API level that defines it as viscous or heavy, any of those things. The gross revenue exclusion concept makes more sense applied to those than it applies to it across the board. Reduction in government take, which can be more simply achieved through other means. To look briefly at what this means, what Senate Bill 3001 would mean for revenue in 2013 based on Department of Revenue 2013 assumptions in terms of costs and levels of production. This is essentially doing the same calculation as was done on that working example a few pages earlier, but looking at it across a wide range of different price decks. On the left, we have what it means for the production tax income, the most important part and the only part that's changing of the system, that would be changing. Then in the blue, the total state take, total government take, so then layering in federal income tax on top of that, what it looks like in terms of cash to companies, and finally, doing some math on that and saying, well, what's the government take in each of these cases? What we see, as pointed out before, is at the $110 level, for instance, a reduction from about $4.782 billion under ACES to $3.6 billion under Senate Bill 3001 if we don't include the impact of the 40% well credit. And taking that down even further to about $3.3 billion if we include the impact of the well credit and assume that about 40% of CapEx that's spent in 2013 would, or is forecast by Department of Revenue to be spent in 2013, would be eligible for that credit. That is not quite as much of a reduction as is entailed by House Bill 110, which would entail only $3.2 billion in revenue from the production tax in 2010, but it's obviously a lot closer to HB 110 than it is to revenue that's received under ACES. What we see, of course, as the price deck rises, is that impact is magnified, and the difference in revenue between those options gets relatively greater. On the government take side, what we see is under ACES, using solely that one fiscal year, 2013, again, this is an issue that's come up before, I'd caution. When we talk about government take figures, we also present in a lot of analysis, life cycle analysis of government take. That life cycle analysis of government take will show figures that are significantly higher than these, because what one has when one looks at the life cycle analysis is the impact of inflation over time, which increases government take because of the issue of lack of cost indexing under ACES, so that effectively when one looks out 20, 30 years, progressivity starts kicking in at lower and lower real levels under ACES, and that creates a higher level of government take when one looks across the life cycle than when one looks just at 2013. So these are just 2013 numbers, and what we have under ACES is, you know, at around $60 a barrel, about 66, 67% government take, rising to about 78% government take at the $200 a barrel level. At the $60 barrel level, we have very similar levels of government take for Senate Bill 3001, slightly lower in the case of including the impact of the credits, and that impacts both HB 110 and Senate Bill 3001. It's greatest in Senate Bill 3001 because of the impact of that 40% credit. The impact on HB 110 is simply the impact of that phasing difference, and that's really a once-off difference of claiming the credits over 2 years versus over 1 year. That's the only difference in government take at $60 a barrel. Otherwise, government take at $60 a barrel is basically the same under all of them. What Senate Bill 3001, both with or without the well credit, and HB 110 do is essentially reduce the effective progressivity. HB 110 does it through bracketing. Senate Bill 3001 does it through the 40% gross revenue exclusion on the progressive tax. But they reduce the progressivity so that one essentially has a much lower slope and government take increasing to about 70%, but no higher than that at the highest levels, and mostly around the mid to high 60s in terms of price levels that we see at the moment, versus the mid 70s under ACES getting up to the high 70s at the highest price levels.
Mr. Mayor, possibly, you know, there's this recent publication called Fiscal Systems for Hydrocarbons, and that was provided to each member of the committee on their committee table at the start of this proceeding. And on page 19, there's a discussion in part about government take, and there's an indication there that it's, you know, it's a fiscal statistic as compared to an economic measure. And they're saying a lot of confusion can arise out of a discussion of government take, and that comparison across jurisdictions of government take can be very difficult and certainly can be misleading. And just wondering if you could, I guess, enlighten us a little bit about, you know, in other words, I understand this is a very complex field, but is, you know, are there some general thoughts that you have regarding this topic of government take?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I certainly agree that benchmarking of government take across different fiscal regimes is complex and difficult and fraught with opportunities for differences of interpretation leading to very different results. One of the things that we've tried to do in all of the benchmarking analysis that we've presented to the committee is to do our analysis based on production profiles and cost estimates that we have in our own databases of new projects in a broad range of jurisdictions around the world. So that is to say, running actual, at least reasonably representative numbers through the model for each jurisdiction, rather than having a single hypothetical field that one is running through all of them. And I think that's important because, you know, the size of the field, the sorts of costs that we see in one jurisdiction are very different to another. And unless one takes that into account, one will get very different government take numbers. What one should be comparing as much as possible is the actual government take likely to be seen in those jurisdictions based on the asset types that they have, based on the costs that they have, rather than what some specifically defined field that may exist absolutely nowhere looks like in each of these jurisdictions. So that's what we've tried to do as much as possible. That's different to the approach that some of these benchmarking exercises undertake and may account, for instance, for some of the differences that one sees there. But without question, there are a lot of moving parts, a lot of variables, and one tries to give as accurate a portrayal as one can based on everything that one knows about the assets and about the regime, but there is always a lot of room for interpretation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator French.
Just on this report, what's the publication date of this report?
Say that again. I believe
the publication date of this report.
There's a reference in here at the beginning to footnote number one. It's talking about a...
I see the spend forecast.
I guess I'm not... 2007.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, look at the next slide, slide 12.
Stedman has a question.
Maybe for those watching at home that want to Google this stuff up, you might want to tell them where it's from and that type of stuff.
Sure.
Define what we're looking at here.
It's captioned Fiscal Systems for Hydrocarbons Design Issues. It's published by the World Bank, Washington, D.C., and it's identified as working paper number 123. For purposes that, it's also already posted on BASIS, so if anyone accesses the Alaska Legislature System BASIS, they can get immediate access to this publication. And it's approximately 31 pages long. So please continue, Mr. Janik, Mayor.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. On slide 12, we then take those same figures in terms of government take percentages based solely on financial year 2013 and compare what that looks like in terms of graphing out what it looks like for ACES versus Senate Bill 3001 for both existing and new production and then HB 110 for existing and new. What we see is that in particular for the existing production and in particular at price levels above $80 or $90 a barrel, Senate Bill 3001 looks really very similar to HB 110. It's in fact entails slightly lower government take at those lower levels, particularly around the $60 a barrel mark, and that is entirely due to the impact at those levels. There is a proportionally greater impact of that 40% well credit, which is what sees a greater divergence at those lower price levels. When looking at new production, again, at around the sort of $100 price level, Senate Bill 3001 for new production versus House Bill 110 for new production look very similar. Senate Bill 3001, again, primarily through the impact of that 30% gross revenue exclusion, actually looks slightly better at the lowest price ranges, but has a higher level of government take at current price levels and upward compared to House Bill 110 for new production.
For purposes of possibly better understanding, you know, the committee has received information from an advisor, Pedro Van Muers, that with respect to existing fields, government take in the range of 70% to 75% was an appropriate range or target range to look for. So under the ACES column, that is representing the government take at $100 a barrel for existing legacy fields?
Broadly speaking, that's correct. I think we reached 75% at about $130 a barrel under ICES. It then goes on to get significantly steeper under as the price deck moves up.
Thank you.
If one looks then at a couple of those different cost sensitivities that we were talking about before, $17 a barrel, $25 a barrel, $34 a barrel, and the question of what project value looks like compared under ICES versus under any of these regimes, what does that do at a range of different price levels to project economics? And what we can see is that if we compare it to either Sonnenbel 3001 for existing or for new production, or to HB110 for existing or new production. Again, HB110 and SB3001 for existing and for new each look relatively similar to each other. And what they do is they bend back that progressivity curve, because fundamentally what each of them is doing is simply reducing progressivity above that 60% trigger. In the case of the $17 barrel field, that actually is at least in net present value terms NPV positive under any of these at moderate price ranges. So in this sense, the impact of on break-even economics on an NPV 10 basis is relatively muted in the $17 barrel field case. But certainly, for instance, if we look at what it takes to reach, let's say, a 15% hurdle rate on internal rate of return, it's taking that from $80 or $90 a barrel on that right-hand chart under ICES down to about, say, $90 a barrel under ICES on that right-hand chart down to $80 a barrel in the existing production scenario, or down to more like $70 a barrel in the new production scenario. And those differences get magnified as we look at the higher cost production. So if we take it up to $25 a barrel and again look at the question of that 15% hurdle rate, in the $25 barrel field, again, for a completely new development, not for an existing producer, what we see is a break-even, what we see is a 15% rate of return at sort of over $130 a barrel versus more like the $100 barrel or just above mark for Senate Bill 3001 for existing, and down below that to more like $90 a barrel under Senate Bill 3001 for new. And then once again, that difference gets magnified further if we look at this in the $34 barrel case. So the basic idea of this is wanting to bend that curve back to allow a hurdle rate for some of these higher cost projects that is at least more feasible at realistic price ranges that one might run hurdle rate economics at. Particularly Sustainable 3001 for new, but also for existing, depending on the sorts of cost levels one is looking at, does achieve that. But as we've said, particularly when one is looking at investments in the legacy fields, it achieves that at a substantial fiscal cost in terms of cash.
Senator Wilkowski had a question. I didn't mean to interject if you were not done with the answers. Anyway, Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just again, I want to get back to the assumptions that you're making here. How much time, I guess how big of a project are you looking at? How many barrels of oil per day would be generated from this project? What are the upfront costs? How much time before you make the initial investment until you have productivity? What sort of assumptions are you using with this model?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, thank you for the question. I didn't include in this deck some of the sort of overall schematics of cash flow that I included when I showed something similar to House Resources yesterday, mostly because it's a cash flow schematic that I've presented to the Senate committees a number of times before. But it's the same basic hypothetical series of cash flows that we've used in some of the analysis before, that is for a small 10,000 barrel a day new field. It takes a couple of, it I think has 2 years of heavy CapEx spending, particularly for facilities development in those early 2 years, and then probably another 5 or 6 years of drilling costs ongoing. Production starting after those 2 years of initial CapEx, probably taking about 3 years to ramp up to production and then having a relatively shallow decline. I'm more than happy to forward some slides of what that cash flow profile actually looks like.
Follow up.
Can we get a copy of the model that you're using to play around with ourselves?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the model that we're using at the moment is very much a working model. It changes every day, particularly as different options are put on the table. It often has workarounds and things hard-coded into so that we can produce analysis very quickly. It's not something that I would recommend anyone else use until we have a finished model on the table, and for that reason, when the legislative program here is done, we will certainly make a cleaned and much more user-friendly version publicly available and available to the entire legislature. But as I think there was some discussion of this morning with Representative Hawker, the idea is that we made available at the end of the process.
Could I, if I just one follow-up, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Could you send me the, I guess, and I wasn't here on Finance Committee, maybe when you went over some of these in detail, but if you could send me all the specific assumptions that you are making, that would be helpful for me. And it would be helpful, I think, Mr. Chairman, to have access to some sort of model that we could play around with, even if it's just a rough working model. I fail to see how we benefit by getting the model after we cast our vote. That just makes absolutely no sense at all to me, Mr. Chairman. We're supposed to set policy here that's going to affect potentially billions of dollars to the state treasury, and we get the model for that after we cast our vote. I would just reiterate that I'd like this model, even if it's a rough model now.
Senator French, do you have a question?
Just a different topic, but similar. The paper that was provided here, the one we referred to earlier, the World Bank Working Paper, Fiscal Systems for Hydrocarbons, pages 22 and 23, I think it offers a nice sort of framework for analyzing future developments. That's the focus of our topic today. And I'm just wondering whether we could do something like that. They provide four different field characteristics, four different fields. And then on the next page, they take each model or each tax regime and apply it to those different models. We could, of course, do it with ACES. We could do it with, 192, the bill that was moving through the legislature. We could do it with 3001 and just sort of give us some different ideas about where we fall at a rough level. Is that something that could be done, Mr. Meyer?
Senator French, without having seen the report that you're...
Oh, you don't have a copy of this?
I don't have a copy.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
You can get approach the witness. Get a copy to... Is this something, Mr. Mayor, that you would like to review before you comment upon, or what is your pleasure at the moment?
Mr. Chair, I would like to review further, but before making a comment, if I could. In general, what I'd say is a lot of these metrics are what we've tried to present in front of Senate Resources and Senate Finance in looking at a number of these things, but if there are particular ways of looking at the data that the committee would like, we can certainly attempt to accommodate them.
Just to follow up, I hadn't seen it. I hadn't seen it done, or if I did, maybe you can just redirect me to the presentation you made. But I hadn't seen it done for fields of different sizes. That was what was helpful to me. Was looking at a field that's going to make 6,000 barrels a day versus 28,000 barrels a day versus 150,000 barrels a day. That just kind of helps me see, where the sweet spot is, and so forth.
Something we. Let me look into that a little further, but and there will will be that question, particularly as the House considers other things as to what specific forms of analysis we can do and what order we can do them in. But in principle, we can certainly try to accommodate that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Please continue, Mr. Mayor. We're approaching the end of the hour and possibly the end of the presentation. So
indeed. Mr. Chair, this is a simple point to make, but and one that there's been some discussion of before in the context of the 40% exploration credit, being that the interaction of 40% well credits with the high rates of progressivity under ACEs mean that you can get very high levels of effective support on an after-tax cash flow basis from the high credits. And that was the case with the 40% exploration credit. That's also the case with extending the 40% well work credit to the North Slope. When we looked at this before in the case of the 40% exploration credit under ACEs, one gets to a point, I think, at around $220 a barrel, where that can even go above 100%. One of the impacts of capping progressivity at 60% is that you at least get rid of that particular feature. But at current price levels at about $120 and higher, you certainly do get very high levels of effective support, effective government support when one includes the 40% credit in the calculation on an after-tax cash flow basis. And apart from anything else, as we've commented before, that's not necessarily very conducive to strong control on strong incentives for cost control.
In other words, this is an area I know that the Senate has been very interested in for quite some time. And Senator Stedman, do you have a question on this?
Oh, yes, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if we could get this in table format. It doesn't need to go out, I mean, take it up to 160 or some number. It doesn't need to go all the way out to 255, but it'd be nice to see it in table format. I think this question was delivered to the Department of Revenue, and it is a point of discussion here as far as the magnitude of the policy and why would we expose the state to this.
Mr. Mayor, is that possible?
To present that data in table form, I'm sure we can accommodate that.
Further question, Mr. Chairman, on this?
Yes, Senator French.
I know we're running out of time, but this is one of the most revealing slides, I think, in today's presentation. And so I think folks who are listening or watching should know. And I just want to make sure I understand it. As I look at this chart and I pick $90 a barrel as a target, at $90 a barrel, we reach 80% after-tax effective government well work contribution. Does that mean that at $90 a barrel, the government is picking up 80% of the costs of that well work?
Senator French, it depends in some ways on how you view things. If you're viewing things from the perspective of the company is fronting up the cash to do that well work and is entitled to take a deduction on some of that, but they'd also get a 40% credit. But if what you're looking at is simply the after-tax cash flow to a company of having done that work, at the end of the year, once they've claimed their deduction, once they've claimed their credit, then it's correct to say that if they spend $100 million on the well work, that they probably only are worse off to the tune of 10 or 20% of that in terms of their after-tax cash flow.
$100 million with the well work, they're going to get back $80 million and in
mostly in the form of reduced tax liability and also then in the form of the 40% tax credit.
And is there any jurisdiction in the world that you're aware of that provides that level of government support?
Off the top of my head, certainly not many. The one thing I'd say, there are two things there. The 40% credit is a high level of support in and of itself, though there are other jurisdictions that have similar sorts of credits. This is a function of the interaction between high levels of progressivity and the credit. And on the one hand, there are two sides to that. One is that implicit to those high levels of progressivity, high levels of effective support, but it's effective support being compared to the taxes that you would pay otherwise, and that's it's also a very high level of tax. So simply to compare it to other jurisdictions is also not a direct comparison, because one may have not have as much support, but it's support in the context of being spared from a very high level of tax, which is not the same thing as outright support, if that makes sense.
Just one more short question, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be finished. Pedro Van Mier's characterizes, you know, sort of a high level of he characterizes our credit system as being generous, one of the most generous credit systems he's aware of. Does this make our generous credit system more generous or less generous?
Senator French, I would agree with the basic idea that this is a generous credit system. It's a generous credit system that exists to make a system with very high government take workable, but it is a generous credit system. And by definition, taking one aspect of that and increasing it from 20% to 40% makes that significantly more generous.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In countries that have higher levels of government support, do they tend to have higher levels of government take?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I wouldn't say they're always correlated, but if one seeks to set up a system that has a high level of government take and also seeks to not make the economics of any given project for a given cost structure non-workable, one way of doing that is to try to make sure as much revenue as possible goes back to contractors early. That can be in the form of credits to reduce their initial costs. That can be in the form of a system that sort of is dependent, as some systems are, for instance, on cost recovery, on rates of return. So, for instance, a number of production sharing contracts around the world may be geared either to an internal rate of return or to something called R factor, for instance, which is the ratio of cumulative costs to cumulative expenses. Those are all ways of trying to return as much cash to contractors, to private investors, as early on in the piece as possible, because by doing so you can still get a workable rate of return for a project while still having a relatively high level of government take on an undiscounted basis, working on the assumption essentially that the government's discount rate, government's time preference for money is much lower than it is for the private sector.
Mr. Mayor, if we have one slide left, and it is noon, and we do possibly, if we could complete this presentation today, I think it would be wise to do so. So if
Mr. Chair, to summarize the key issues here, then the simplest approach to take, if simplicity and lack of unintended consequences are the prime motivation, is an across-the-board reduction in government take to improve economics of new investments in legacy fields. But there is a significant cost in doing that, which is it foregoes significant revenue on activities that, without question, are currently economic.
Well, Mr. Mayor, you know, I think this is in part the question of the moment, you know, is all elected officials owe fiduciary duties to the state, and if, you know, why would one do across-the-board reductions for activities that are currently economic? In other words, if you're fulfilling a fiduciary duty to the state.
Mr. Chairman, I think it depends entirely on questions of exactly how one interprets that fiduciary duty to the state. It depends on many things. It depends on what level of revenue the state needs at what price level, and what does the state see as the fitting role for the state in this process in terms of the value it needs to get for its resources versus the value that should accrue to the private sector for the work that it undertakes, for the investment that it makes to make these things happen. Now, it similarly depends on interpretations and outlook in terms of what should a fiscal system do. Should a fiscal system exist to extract the maximum possible rent from every different asset, which inevitably involves a lot of granularity, a lot of complexity in the system? In many ways, that's exactly what production sharing contracts around the world exist to do, which is for each any given development governments, usually through a strong national oil company, sitting down with a producer and saying, okay, let's you can bid with a number of other people on exactly what level of government take is going to apply into this contract, and then you'll have stability over the next 20, 30 years. By contrast, a large number of jurisdictions, mostly developed country jurisdictions around the world, take a different approach, which is to say we want to set one simple, consistent, standard set of terms. We want to make sure that that set of terms gets a reasonable level of government take for us, but also ensures healthy levels of returns for individual companies. But we want to set a single standard framework and let the private sector play and do what they do best. Those are fundamentally differences of approach, and there's gradations between them. But how one interprets one's fiduciary duty in that sense is in many ways as much a judgment call about what one sees as the role of the state in this particular activity and the degree of return that it needs from the resource that it owns.
In other words, it's a complex issue when one is analyzing the currently economic activity as compared to the potential future activities that are as yet unknown, and that's where that fiduciary duty becomes, I guess, most important. So.
Now, to conclude, I would say it's not impossible, for instance, that under such a scenario, one could at some point in time have increased revenue simply by having by cutting taxes to this point. For instance, if, again, purely hypothetically, we said legacy fields at the moment are declining at 6%, if that could be reduced to, for instance, 2%, then there would be a point in time, if I run through the model, I think it's about 2020, where if that change in the decline rate comes entirely from this change in taxes, you get a crossover, and the increased production at that point in the future generates enough increased revenue that you're actually better off for having done so. That change in decline rate is not inconceivable, but it's also certainly not guaranteed. And so, again, it comes back to that question of fiduciary duty and interpretation of fiduciary duty on a lot of unknowables in the future, and what one thinks is a prudent course of action accordingly. If one doesn't want to go down that path of saying, okay, we're going to take a risk here, substantially reduce government take, and see what happens in terms of increased production, if one wants to be more cautious and say, we don't want to put that much cash back for current economic activities, but we do want to provide a significant incentive for new production, then inevitably one is back in this question of trying to differentiate between existing production from legacy fields versus incremental production from them, and how one might draw that line, whether that be a decline curve, whether that be a regulatory process where government agencies can make that determination, and then one has to get deeper into that discussion. It adds significant complexities to the system, but it avoids, at least to some extent, the need to put substantial cash back for existing economic activity. The final point I'd make is that Senate Bill 3001 doesn't address a number of other key issues that we've discussed in great length, both here in Senate Resources Committee and also in Senate Finance Committee, particularly this question of oil versus gas decoupling and the impact of large-scale gas development on production tax values and therefore on production tax rates of existing oil producers. Nor does it direct the other question we've looked at, which is high levels of support that exist through the combination of high credits and progressivity, particularly the most prominent example we've discussed so far being the 40% exploration credit. Not only does it not address that, other than through reducing the maximum rate of progressivity from 75 to 60%, which perhaps addresses some of the worst of that. But it also, in some ways, contributes further to that question by extending the 40% well credit to the North Slope.
Any additional questions for Mr. Janik Mayer? Mr. Mayer, we very much appreciate your willingness to accommodate the schedule by going a little bit over the or past the hour, Given that, we complete the presentation today by PFC Energy, and again, thank Mr. Janet Mayer for that. And given that, we will adjourn Senate Resources for this Tuesday, April 24th. We are adjourned.